Session number 14806.
Eddie Murray, side three. Eddie Murray, side three. So, what happened once you arrived in Bel Abbes?
Into the it wasn't into the main barrack square that we went, which is the Quartier Viennot barracks, the Viennot barracks, after a famous old colonel, but into the what they call the Bureau de Passagers. You know,
transit.
That's right, the transit barracks. And there were three of those: CP1, CP2, CP3, whichever one we went to. CP2 it was, and went in there and saw this, you know, officer. And I happened to mention that during my youth I'd played the mandolin. Mm-hmm. See, at home, I'd been asked what we did at home, and I said used to have musical evenings with my father playing the mandolin and tin whistle and me playing the mandolin after him, you know, very badly. Mm. Immediately. I mean, there's no question about it. I didn't have anything to say in the matter at all. We put you down for the music. They're asking for volunteers for the music, do you see? You've just volunteered for the music. And so, probably the next day, within hours, you know, I was in the music in the main barracks square, up on the left-hand side there, and being interviewed by the deputy chief of the music, Monsieur Petit, who asked me if I played an instrument. I said, no, I played the mandolin and the banjo, but that's all. Oh, no wind instrument. And I said, no. Well, would you like to? I said, yes, I'd like to play a tenor saxophone. Do you see? And so, well, he said...
Why a tenor saxophone?
I don't know, it just came to mind. And so he said, well, we'll see about that.
Yes.
And I think he was very surprised at my French. He said, your French is excellent, you know, very good indeed. I'll show you next door. Come next door. Introduced me to a Lance Sergeant Villars and a first-class musician, Van Damme, who I found out later on was a first prize winner in the... Conservatory of Namur in Belgium. Tenor, he was a tenor. And he used to sing with the orchestra, as a matter of fact. And I used to sing with the dance orchestra. But only on a couple of occasions. And so Van Damme was there. This was in the office. Mm. You see? And that was where I was posted to, the office of the music.
Ah, right.
And it was enjoyable. I mean, but where was the adventure I was looking for, do you see?
But what was going to happen? You hadn't done any basic training then?
No. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry.
Right.
I've got it all mixed up, haven't I?
Well, I didn't
because
know.
from the transit office, we didn't go straight to the music. But he wrote down that I was for the music.
Right.
You see? And then off down to Saida.
You know, for the basic training.
For the basic training, which was the company of instruction, CI-1. And there was another one at Ain El Hadja, which was a little bit further south, and to the east, on the edge of the Sahara Desert. Saida was in the foothills of the Atlas Mountains. Still desert, but with lots and lots of boulders and stones, and very,
and
very uncomfortable.
How long did you stay there?
13 weeks, if I remember.
13 weeks,
right.
Basic
training. That's 3 months, basic training.
Yeah. And what did the syllabus consist of?
Lots and lots of rifle training. Manimont d'armes, rifle drill, yes. Mm. Of course, when the sergeant stood there and said, slope arms, in French, even in French, you know, I knew the commands. Slope arms up, I went, you see, like I'd been taught at Caterham. And he wasn't very, very happy about that.
Why not? Because you knew what to do?
No.
Because it was a different style.
It was a different style. I didn't do it the right way, do you see. But, you know, very, very quickly I learned. I was extremely good at drill, arms drill and grenades. And we used to do a lot of, quite a lot of shooting on the rifle range. And we did a lot of grenade throwing and pieced obstacle. Assault course, yes. Yeah. Like they do on Krypton Factor.
All right.
And that was just, you know, the assault course was just behind the barracks, as a matter of fact, inside, I remember it well, and in Sidi Blabes, as a matter of fact. And so there was a lot of that, and then we used to go out marching, you know, for the first week, maybe not more than 5 kilometres there and 5 kilometres back, right, and then gradually increasing.
And were you given better uniforms?
Oh, yes, of course.
You got proper uniforms.
We had proper, more or less proper uniforms, yes. Yes, we had the summer. It was summer, do you see, and so we had the summer khaki, just like we'd been wearing. But we had putties and new boots and socks and underwear. And still the... we had the KP issued. And the white, to put on the KP.
The white cover. Mm-hmm.
And also we had the neck cover too issued, which was a blooming nuisance. Because
what was this?
The neck cover, which is...
Oh, down at the back.
Yeah.
Why was that in your... Well, that, did the neck cover form part of the cover?
Only in the Saharan thing? Regions.
Yes.
Only in the Sahara regions. But at that time, of course, although they... I feel sure that they knew that I was going to the music in Sidi Blabes. We were called out on one occasion, very, very close, during the last days of our training, to a village about... probably 20 or 30 miles away, and we had to go there, the whole of the company. So, about 50 of us, I suppose, mm-hmm. with Lieutenant Pepin Le Halleur. And we went this, we marched, it was overnight when we had to get there, and we got there early the next morning, or during the course of the morning, and surrounded the village, and then the villagers gave up, and then... apparently, I found out later on, but I mean, you told nothing at all. Nobody told you. Suddenly, the whistle would go, or the trumpet would sound, and you'd have to go down to into assembly, do you see, and form, and you'd pick your rifle up on the way down. This was normal procedure. But you never knew why you were going there. If it was in the morning, of course, it was for training. And if it was after the siesta, then it was for training. You knew that.
Did you find out what had happened with this village?
Yes, but when it comes at midnight, then there's something special.
Right.
And they still didn't tell you, but I found out later on that they'd murdered, the Arabs there had murdered a couple of French colonists. And, of course, the Caïds had to be taken care of, if you like. And so we marched there.
So that means what, Caïds?
The Karaids are the chiefs, chief of the village, the village chiefs.
Right, okay.
Kaid is the boss.
Okay.
Even as a...
When you say taken care of means?
Oh, we never knew. I mean, all we knew was that shortly afterward...
Dealt with.
Once we got there, yes. Once we got there and surrounded the village, and the bosses, the chiefs of the village were down on the three of them, were down on their knees sort of business waiting for us to approach, then lorries came from the direction of Sidi Blabes, where I don't know where, I think they came from Mascara, colonial troops, not legion this time, and two or three lorries full of these colonial troops, and they got out, and there was a major there, and he came up and saw the lieutenant, and the three miscreants were handed over and bundled into one of the lorries, and off the lorries went, and we just packed up and turned round and went back, and we were met part of the way by a mobile kitchen and had a meal then. Mm. Otherwise, all we'd had, you see, was this bit of bread, slice of bread, a respectable size, and a bit of chocolate and a couple of sardines.
And that was okay.
And that was...
That was a snack en route.
That was, yes. And bidons, our water bottles, filled with water, of course. Some of them used to fill it with red wine, you know. But the sergeant was always aware of that because he'd done the same thing himself. And if you were caught doing that, then the rest of the march, you see, you had to do without any water at all, and the wine had been poured out. And you'd get at least 7 days prison when you got back. And nobody was allowed to to help you on the way back with water.
Right. Okay. So you were 13 weeks at Sidi Bel Abbes, I beg your pardon, at Saida. Saida. And
We weren't allowed out in Saida.
No. What was this, just this flap thing at the back of the
just a sun cover to protect the neck from
yes, and
from
how
the
was
sun.
That attached to the rest of the kepi?
With little eyelets of thread. And here there was, of course, there are a couple of buttons. There's a button here and a button there for the for the strap, the chin strap that goes around the top of the visor.
Yes.
You see, and the chin strap, of course, went around the chin. It was extensible, and but the two buttons there, and used to stretch it around the back of the around the back of the,
but
the bottom of the KP.
But it sounds like, as you said, a nuisance to
absolutely not
to
only
thread
that.
It on. We got dirty.
I mean, we never wore it. We only wore it in the Saharan region. But it had to be kept clean and presented.
Yes.
At you know, when you had to effects inspections.
Why didn't you think of joining the RCMP or something like that, or the
what
South
a good
African
question.
Something?
What a good question, because at the Holborn restaurant, one of my fellow checking clerks had been in the Canadian Mounted Police, and by golly, he was a good-looking man with a ginger moustache and ginger hair, and really a beau geste type.
Mm.
Why didn't I go? I didn't think I'd ever be able to make my way to Canada. It seemed so much easier going to North Africa or going to France.
Mm. But I mean, what about those things like the Hong Kong police and South Africa something or other, or Rhodesia? Wasn't it that time?
When I first came down to London, so at the age of 16 or 17, I tried to get it at the Metropolitan Police Force, and they wouldn't have me. Apparently I had, they said flat feet. But eventually I found out that it wasn't flat feet, it's what's called varicocele. That's an enlarged testicle, which doesn't hurt, nothing at all.
Okay, right. Sounds painful. Okay, we'll go on.
Yeah. That was a kick at football at school.
But these other things like the Hong Kong police or something.
Well, if I couldn't get into the Metropolitan
Police. Oh, you weren't going to get in that. No,
I wasn't going to get into that. That's the way I thought.
Ah, of course, yes.
Do you see?
You got through the medical at the Marseille.
Much, much stiffer medical in Marseille than in the Metropolitan Police Force. But I also got a medical shortly afterwards for the guards.
And that was okay. Yes. What was the atmosphere during the basic training? Was it very, very harsh?
It was very, very tough.
Mm-hmm.
And
did many people drop out?
We didn't know. Suddenly, a face wouldn't be there. But you know, it was. I remember one bloke whose father had a big furniture shop in London, in the West End. I haven't divulged his name in the book, but he pinched my, because you get what's called a prime d'engagement. You get 1,000 francs, which I didn't know about. You get 1,000 francs after you've done your basic training, or when you've started your basic training, halfway through. You get a third of it, 300 francs, and then another 300 francs after a fortnight or after a month or something. And then after the third month, you know, you get 400 francs. Mm. That's 1,000 francs, which is a lot of money. I mean, we used to get a halfpenny a day in there. You know,
yes.
It was 15 francs a fortnight, which is a franc a day. Plus, of course, a packet of cigarette tobacco.
Yes.
And a glass of wine every meal.
15 francs a day was how much?
Two on birthdays, 15 francs.
It was,
but you couldn't spend it except on sandwiches in the naffy.
And how much was a packet of cigarettes then?
Bastos. Well, I didn't buy them.
No.
Probably about 5 francs. Or 2 francs 50, I think. 2 francs 50 for 20.
Right.
About that.
And a glass of beer or something was how much? I'm just trying to find out 15
yes,
francs.
Yes, I'm just trying to remember.
It was about a tenner a fortnight in modern terms, I think. I mean, judging from what.
No,
you're
beer
saying.
Was very, very cheap. But it was, and you could either have it blonde or brune. I used to have a beer occasionally, but in those days I didn't drink alcohol.
Okay.
No, I didn't drink alcohol.
Right.
I used to have lemonade, probably a shandy.
Yes.
You know.
But I mean, in modern terms, 15 francs was next to nothing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
I see what you mean, yes.
Yes.
Well, I said a halfpenny a day.
An English halfpenny a day.
An English halfpenny a day.
Right.
So that was seven
and
halfpenny.
One and three a week or something.
Seven
one and
three
a fortnight.
Yeah. Seven and halfpenny a fortnight in those
days.
Oh,
yes, sure.
Which was seven and halfpenny.
It was about 3p nowadays.
Yes. Well, yes, right. Yes.
3p a fortnight.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I mean, you didn't go out there to make a fortune.
No.
I went there for adventure.
Right. okay, let's...
So it's cider. There's lots and lots of hard work.
Yes.
With the rifle and going down on your stomach in the, as I said, you know, the lower Atlas Mountains and lots and lots of brick heaving when there was walls to be built
right.
or roads to be built.
What about discipline? And if you didn't get it right, they'd give you a clip, or how did that work?
Oh, you were confined to barracks, but most of the time, if you didn't do it properly or you made yourself a bit of a nuisance, then you had piquet d'incendie, you know, fire
picket. Yeah. To be up all night.
And then, more or less, yes, yeah. So be called out a couple of times. Or, and then you get salle de police, which meant that after the meal of an evening, you'd be called up and you'd have to do fire picket. Then you'd have to sweep the barracks. And then the next morning, you'd be awakened about 5 o'clock in the morning to sweep out the prison block, or the salle de police block, which was not the prison actually, although there were bars to the doors, and you'd have been awakened at least twice during the night, just to make sure you went for a pee, do you see? But it was just a punishment, that's all.
What groups were there apart from the Germans there?
There were quite a lot of Spanish people come across from. Fascist Spain, do you
right.
see?
What were they like?
They were, you know, like the Germans. They were, they kept themselves to themselves up to a point. Mm. But if one had an argument with me, I used to keep out of arguments, you know. And what's more, I was the unknown number, do you see? They didn't know how to take me. I was very correct to them and polite to everybody, and I did my work properly, and I did it. Probably better than any of them, and so I was a force more or less to be reckoned with if I was required. But the idea was that I got to them to say, was keep out of my backyard and I'll keep out of yours. Mm-hmm. And so, but if ever there was a, for instance, we had, although the French were not allowed to join the Legion officially, they could join as Swiss or British or American or Chinese. No, not Chinese. Up till 37, I think, the Chinese and the Eastern natives were allowed to join the Legion, but there weren't very many of them. And I think it all finished at Sidi Bou Abbès when I was there, when a Chinese legionnaire who had been the batman to one of the lieutenants made approaches to the lieutenant's wife. It was in a flat above the or near the cinema, I remember. Then he threw all the furniture out of the window.
Who, the Chinaman?
The Chinaman. And it seems to me that almost immediately afterwards there was a ban on Orientals
joining
the
Legion.
Since when, I think it's been changed.
Mm. Mm.
Because of the number of Orientals in France, particularly. But so the Frenchman joins as Swiss, we'll say, or Luxembourgeois, Belgian. But after the end of 5 years, he... sends a request to the Minister of War asking that he be permitted to regain his French civilian status. And 9 times out of 10, if he's kept his nose clean throughout the time, you see, he's allowed to. Now, if he's had a wife, then of course she comes into it, and then he's you know, a certain amount of his pay is deducted for his wife.
Mm.
But very often they don't declare that they are married, but they're allowed to serve as French. Now, if they'd been in the French army, instead of a threepence a fortnight, they would have been getting sixpence a fortnight, shall we say, or maybe ninepence a fortnight. You see?
Yes.
It's a different... You know.
Sure. Why did most of these chaps seem to have joined up?
Ah, I'll finish
all right.
this.
All right.
Now then, these Frenchmen, you see, they would have received, say, shall we say, sixpence a fortnight. Now then, but they haven't. They've only been receiving three in the Legion, do you see, three pence.
Yes, yes.
Now then, when they're allowed to resume their nationality there, and their status, French status, they get back pay.
They get back pay.
That's 5 years back pay of threepence a fortnight, you see. And so, you know, it's in their interest, more or less, to do it as late as possible. Now then, so why did they join? Well, the Spaniards, of course, they came because they were dissatisfied with the fascist regime
yes.
in Spain. And lots of them had been cowards anyhow. Didn't care much for the Spaniards. Kept out of their way as much as possible.
How did you find?
They were dirty, they were untidy, and they were slovenly. And so they would get you into trouble. You know, if you're a member of a group, and you've got a Spaniard there who's doing, who's not doing his best, then the whole group gets into trouble.
Right.
Not just him.
Right.
You see? And so, and slovenliness, you know, dirtiness and slovenliness.
Slovenliness, yes.
And, inattention to work and not learning your lessons, do you see, about how the rifle works or how the cannon works and all this sort of thing. They just, 90% of them didn't do it. Mm. And so everybody used to get into trouble because of that. The Germans, they, on the other hand, I think about 90% of them really went to town on their arms and how to take them to pieces and put them together again, do you see. Mm. They were very, very ammo-minded, if you like. And they were, they seemed to be able to take the rough stuff much better than the Spaniards, much better than me, really, I think, you know, if the truth were known. And so they were disciplined, most of them, you see. But they were also very much of a clique, you know. And if anything went wrong, if they had an argument with a Spaniard or with a Frenchman or anything like that, they were together immediately, do you see? And it was the whole of the German army that was against you, not just one single person. Yes.
Were the Spanish very political, would you say?
I would think that over 50% of them were red-hot communists. Mm. Yes, and they were very communist-minded. But it didn't interfere at all with the Legion. Mm. Not at all. And they talked a lot.
Amongst themselves.
Well,
discussing.
Yes.
Yes.
Probably political yes. discussions. Yes. But, and there were a lot of Spanish people in Sidi Bou Abbès, for instance, civilians.
Yes.
And also down in Ceuta. And all, you know, throughout the whole of North Africa, there were lots of Spaniards. Mm.
And, okay.
Because part of Morocco, of course, was Spanish Morocco.
Yes. Did they feel they were persecuted, the Spanish, or how did that work?
Well, now that you mention it, I suppose that the majority of them sort of had a chip on their shoulder.
Well, I was going to say, were they bolshy? Yes. I didn't mean necessarily politically, I meant attitude-wise. Yeah.
They were bolshy. Mm. Not among themselves, but bolshy as far as other people were concerned.
Yeah. Did they feel, I mean, I'm asking a leading question, but they sort of reckon they're being picked on, did they, or how did they?
All the time.
Really?
All the time.
Really?
Yes. But the trouble is that they were being picked on. I mean, they didn't do the arms drill, you know, the rifle drill. They were hopeless at it. Mm. And I'm talking, you know, if I say 99.5%, I mean that.
Mm.
The Spaniards were really hopeless. They were, as I said, slovenly. And, yes.
Okay. What about at that stage, or theft, or anything, people nicking things off other legionnaires?
The only thing that was ever nicked from me, and I tell it in the book, was this English bloke whose father has, I don't know what now, probably sold them, but had in those days furniture shops in the West End of London. And he pinched my first Prima 300 francs. I was sitting there. We just arrived and we were there. He was there before me, as a matter of fact, but waiting to form a complete company of instruction. And he'd been one of the earlier ones that was there. But, we were sitting there, and as one does, as one shouldn't do, I suppose, I took my photographs out of my wallet and put my wallet down there and showed the photographs that I had. See? And suddenly I realized that three of them had gone, had left the, they were no longer sitting on the bed. One had gone to get dressed for guard duty, and one had gone to the toilet, and one was getting ready for some other thing, you see. Three of them was there. And the bloke that was left was an Irishman called Kavanagh, who had been, confessed to having been in several English prisons. Mm. And he was he had a barrel chested, is the correct name for him.
Yeah.
But, he wasn't a nice bloke to know, really. But he was the only one that was left there, English speaking. And so I collared him as soon as I realized that the wallet was there, but the 300 francs had gone.
Yes.
And the corporal was sitting there vis-a-vis, and I took this Irishman across, and I told the corporal to search him, because he was the one that stood out, more or less, having a prison record. And then, but he didn't have anything, and the corporal says, that's all right. Find the others. Let's find the others. And so he came with me, and we looked, and the bloke that was going for guard, well, he was all right. He was dressing down on the floor below. And then we went to see this bloke whose name starts with D, and he was Jewish. And there he was, getting ready for some guard or something like that. And so we searched him, nothing. And suddenly I realized, but he said, "You're going to the toilet." So he said, no, I was dressing. And I said, "I think we better go back to the toilet." And so the corporal and I heaved him back, to the toilet. And, by this time I was quite sure it was him, absolutely certain. And so I told him, I said, "I know it's you, and you're going to get the biggest hiding, And there he showed us, behind the toilets, which were brick-built, more or less. There was a brick, that moved.
Yeah.
And the 300 francs were in there.
All right.
Yeah.
So what happened after that?
Now then, the corporal was there, so I couldn't do anything about it. And so he was on report for the next day, and the next day he saw the captain. And 2 days later, once again, we didn't know anything, except afterwards what happened, But a couple of days after the incident, he took the train to Oran, and there was a plane there, it was a flying field at Oran, and a private plane was there to pick him up and fly him back to England, medically unfit. That was D.
Really? But he wasn't charged or anything?
No.
No, they weren't going to have him.
And at the same time, I had a letter from my father. My father saying that he'd been in touch with Aunt Need and to get me out. And I wrote back and I said, "No way, I don't want to get out. I've signed for 5 years. I'm doing 5 years. I'm happy here."
Did he know Aunt Need?
Well, Aunt Need was Foreign Secretary. Now, when I won a beautiful babies competition in the mining village, it was run by the WI, and the local president of the WI was Lady Eden, who lived at Priestfield, a couple of miles from our village.
So you had a connection.
And she presented the prize, which was a bag of salt, bag of salt, which was supposed to bring. I was very, very small, Bonnie baby, which was apparently a good luck charm for Bonnie babies. And that's how. And so I think he probably related the incident.
Let's just change over this tape.